Welcome to Understory, RTRFM's environmental forum each Wednesday morning at 11:30. My name is Lisa Litchens, and today we're going to be hearing from Tom Wilson, who has been investigating the sunset frog and other WA frog species. He's talking with Helen Robertson from the Perth Zoo. We also have Adrian Glamorgan, who spoke with Peter Robertson, the State Director for the Wilderness Society, about the top environmental priorities in our northwest. But firstly, I caught up with Gary Warden from Days of Change to talk about their recent pilot program in York. If you've heard of Days of Change, you'll know they're a grassroots organization with a great idea and strategies for making a difference to climate change. I asked Gary what Days of Change is all about.
Well, Days of Change is a program which is trying to help people make simple changes within their lives to live more sustainably and produce less greenhouse gas emissions and also save a bit of money in the process. It was a program that actually came about, it was developed by a guy called Julian Illich, who was working for the Department for Environment and Conservation at the time about 18 months ago. And he was engaged by them to develop a community-based climate change, a behaviour change program, and he did that. But ultimately, funding for new climate change programs under the previous government was cut. So Julian decided to take this program on and try and run it, I guess, external to government, and I met up with Julian about the middle of last year, and so we've been working together ever since to get the program up and running. So our goal is to engage with 200,000 West Australians next year to help them take simple actions and then to expand nationally and then internationally thereafter.
That sounds ambitious and heroic, I think, at the same time, Gary. Did you know Julian beforehand, or did you just meet through paths of being environmentally aware?
Yes, well, it was actually quite serendipitous, really. We happened to meet when Ross Garnaut came across to deliver his interim report at the Perth Town Hall, and so he was aware of me. I'm one of Al Gore's climate ambassadors, and so he came up and met with me and explained the program, and really it was just I guess quite fortunate that I guess I was in a position to be able to support him, and so we've been working together ever since.
That's fantastic. So Gary, tell us, how does it actually work? How does the program work?
Well, it's really what sets this program apart from a lot of other programs. A lot of traditional, for example, government-run programs in the area of behaviour change tend to focus very much on a one unidirectional delivery of information from the government. So, for example, I'd like to think of a classic example would be, you know, natural power. Synergy offers all customers access to natural power. They put advertising pamphlets in the bills that they send out on a regular basis, but that's spectacularly unsuccessful in terms of getting people to make changes. As we've seen, less than 1% of subscribers within Western Australia have actually signed up for that.
Yeah. Gary, do you have any thoughts on why that is?
Well, I think, and this is one of the things, we've gone out and actually done some surveys to try and understand, well, what is stopping people from taking a whole range of actions, and one of them would be natural power, the other things would be, you know, putting panels on your solar panels on your roof, the other thing would be, you know, ditching the old electric hot water system. Specifically with natural power, you know, the barriers there are obviously it costs a little bit extra in order to be able to subscribe to natural power. The other barrier is people just simply don't know about it. In my capacity as a our World Climate Ambassador, I speak to literally thousands of people every year, and I'm still shocked by the really tiny percentage of people who I ask actually know about it, and so which really demonstrates that this strategy of advertising and putting pamphlets in envelopes in bills, just it doesn't work. It's an unsuccessful approach, and really that's where our approach is different. We're really trying to actually get change happening on a massive scale, and a scale which really hasn't been seen before, in certainly in Western Australia. And so the program's based around a list of actions that people can take that both reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, helps them live more sustainably, and also helps them save money in the process. And the actions are really across a very broad spectrum of things you can do. There's actions around trying to reduce your electricity use, for example, just simple things like switching the lights off or replacing your incandescent light globes with more energy efficient versions, through to waste reduction actions, so composting, water reduction actions, things like low flow shower heads, or scrapping 50 square metres of lawn and putting in some water efficient vegetation, and then all the way through to, you know, more complex actions which might take a bit more commitment, so things like installing ceiling insulation, putting solar panels on the roof, and maybe actually going out there engaging other people to take action as well. Put all these actions together on, it's what we call a pledge card, 30 actions, and people can see how much greenhouse gases they're going to save as a result of doing those actions, and they can also see actually how much the money they're going to save, because that's one of the other key things we want to try and change with this program, is this perception out there that it costs money to be green.
Well, this is it, Gary, isn't it? Because, I mean, really, the green power isn't that much more. I guess it's things like your hot water and solar panels that are more, but in the long run, you're going to save. But I guess my question is to you then, how do you then propose to get your message out in the way that Synergy hasn't?
Yeah, well, the core of the program is a social networking website. So we've developed a website which is, you know, the equivalent of Facebook, I guess, in terms of social networking. But the focus of our website is really about networking in relation to taking action on sustainability. And so people join up with the program and they get a profile on the Days of Change website, and they can make their pledges, and there's a lot of information available on that website which tells them how to go about doing those actions, tries to break down some of those barriers that might exist in people's minds, some of the myths and mistruths that exist about certain actions. And we also put people in touch with, you know, relatively low-cost alternatives as well. We're running the program currently in York as a pilot, so, for example, people can buy low-flow shower heads or energy-efficient light bulbs or electric bikes, for example, at 10 to 15% off the normal retail prices. And so that's part of the program as well.
Okay, that sounds like a great initiative. And how did that go recently, Gary, your launch in York? Because I believe you chose it because it was a small community.
Yes. Yes, well, we chose York really to be a microcosm, I guess, of Western Australia when we roll out the program next year. There's a population of 3,000 people in York. You know, the economy is relatively diverse compared to some other small towns, and it's got a relatively well-connected community, and that was really one of the keys to the selection of the pilot town as well, because really one of the key factors with Days of Change is creating this strong sense that everybody's making change, and sort of rather than the people who are putting solar panels on the roof or subscribed to natural power feeling as though they're fighting a losing battle, people get a strong sense that everybody's out there trying to do stuff. And so that's what we've set out to achieve in York. We had our launch on August 1 and had about 100 people come along to attend that launch. It's been strongly supported by the local council, by local businesses, by the local high school. And since August 1, we've now got 180 people who've signed up and made pledges. And, you know, people might think, gosh, that doesn't sound like very many people, but translated on a per capita basis right across Western Australia, that's equivalent to about 120,000 people.
Yeah, look, I think that sounds like an excellent start, actually, in such a short time. So, Gary, what's next? You've got your big launch next year. How do you see Days of Change in the future, in the near future?
Well, we're going to analyse the results from York, and then we'll sit back and assess what worked and what maybe needs improving. We then go out to our major corporate sponsors. Currently, we're running on a shoestring and running on a largely voluntary basis or with pro bono services, and quite frankly, we can't continue to do that if we want to roll it out across Western Australia. So once we can demonstrate that the program works in York, we'll go out there for some corporate sponsorship and then roll it out across Western Australia, and then we'll start talking with other people in other states and other countries.
That was Gary Warden, co-director and founder of Days of Change. If you would like to know more about it and start making your pledges, go to daysofchange.org. We're now going to hear from Tom Wilson talking with Helen Robertson from the Perth Zoo about threatened frog species in WA.
Three threatened species are Eugenia crinia alba, which is endangered, probably technically critically endangered, but it hasn't been reassessed or, you know, applied for upgrading, if you like.
Those are the few frogs in the other area of the building we're standing in right now.
That's right, yes. Geocrinia vitellina are listed as vulnerable, and the other endangered species is the sunset frog, whose real name is Spica spina flammacerulea.
I prefer sunset frog.
I like the other one, actually. It's kind of cool once you get your tongue around it. It's a very fancy name for a very, very fancy frog. We might show you one of those in a minute. So those three frogs are threatened. The other frog species in Western Australia are not currently in a threatened state. However, with climate change and chytrid fungus, they could in the future. Also, the other major thing that affects frogs is habitat destruction, because, of course, as soon as you drain a creek or drain a swamp or fill it with a suburb, you can't have frogs there anymore.
And what have been the big causes of species loss or numbers lost for these species?
Probably habitat loss would be a major factor, particularly around Margaret River. If you look at the main industry around there, it's wineries or grape growing.
So the frogs to my left are from the Margaret River region?
That's correct, yeah. So not all wineries, but many would like to control and dam the creeks to have a good water supply in the drier season here in Perth. And so once you dam a creek and change the way the hydrology works, you then ruin these little guys' habitat, because they haven't got that slowly seeping creek line running down to a little tiny creek. They've got a big dam. Where they used to live is underwater, so that doesn't work for them.
So it sounds like you should have sponsorship from a few Margaret River wineries to me.
There are some wineries doing a very good job and preserving habitat for these frogs, and there are others that haven't, so... But we're not mentioning any names.
Sure, that's fine.
Let's go next door and have a quick look at the speaker spinner. We'll leave the albers alone. We just need to make sure that we squidge our shoes again on the way out. So again, we need to squidge our shoes.
Okay, we've just entered another of these low, detached buildings.
And here's an open one. I'll just clean my hands and just get my jacket off.
Sure.
And we'll have a look at a sunset frog. These little guys are not normally seen by people. So...
These were discovered quite late in the day, is that right?
I think it was 96, so you've got a photograph of one there. You can
1996,
see
that's know, pretty that's recently really recent, to be discovering
yeah,
frog.
So it's kind of cool to think that something so startling in appearance could remain hidden for so long. But when you find out how these guys live, it's not surprising. They live in relic peat bogs down near Walpole. And the animals themselves live in burrows that they enter underneath the water and then burrow up into the peat to where that's dry land, if you like, or it's obviously not dry, but they're not underwater. A bit like a platypus burrow, if you like, so the entry's underwater.
Right.
And then they go up, and so they're actually completely hidden unless it's breeding season. And then they all come out the males sit around in the shallow ponds calling for the females, who quickly find them, and then they go into Texas. These guys do lay eggs in the water, but not big egg masses like you see for the Latoria morii, the motorbike frog, for example. They lay individual eggs, which they individually attach to the substrate, so the weed or so forth. So they lay up to about 50 to 100 eggs, one at a time.
And this is
quite different.
An old species, their history as a species, would they have been around for millions of years?
Yes, they would be. They don't have any close relatives, really. They're in a genus all on their own.
So maybe from an earlier time when we were covered with rainforests in Southwest Australia.
Oh, definitely their habitat is old rainforest site. But of course, there's no rainforest there anymore, so... If you have a look just down in there, you can see where the burrow is. So we'll just chase the burrow down.
So I'm just peering into a quite a wet vivarium covered in this moss, this brown stuff that looks like sawdust to me, but is definitely moss. And I can see a brown lump, well, a much darker brown lump. And Helen's just picking it up with her gloves. And we've got a squirming, alive sunset frog with a beautiful orange belly.
Yes, this is where they get their name from. So truly sunset. And if you look at them on the top, they're that dark navy blue colour. And then if I gently roll him over, you can see underneath his chin and on his belly and on his feet is bright orange. And it's basically the idea is that you've got the sun setting. So you've got the dark night sky with just the last little bit of sunset if you look at him front on like that. So
he's looking straight at me on the sitting there on the white glove on Helen's hand, and he's very small, probably the size of a 50-cent coin, maybe slightly larger.
Yeah, and he'd be about six times the size of a geocrinia. So that's why I didn't try and show you a geocrinia. They're very small. Right. But we'll just put him back in his burrow.
What I'm looking at right now, I suppose, is potentially one of the first fatalities to global climate change in southwest Australia.
That is certainly a possibility, because the peat bogs, swamps, with the lessening rainfall, the water needs to come up through the peat bog and produce shallow ponds during the breeding season, which is December, January. And so if there isn't enough rain to bring the water up to that height, they won't have a breeding event. And the other thing that happens with them is that the peat bogs, when they dry out in that fashion, become very acidic. So they normally are acidic peat bogs, but you'd be looking at pHs like 4 or 5. When we first started working with this species, we took our pH meter down and we're getting readings of about 2.3, 2.4, which is equivalent to vinegar.
Wow.
So that's a serious issue for this frog.
And I suppose that's one of the major problems for conservation biology in Western Australia, is that the species that are going to go extinct first are often relic ones that are left over from an earlier time when we were much wetter. So with global climate change drying us out here in Western Australia, those tiny little spots where it is still wet enough for these species to hang on are going to dry up. And it may be the case that in a few decades' time, the only place you'll find a sunset frog is at the Perth Zoo. Do you think that's possible?
Let's hope not.
Let's hope not, definitely.
To be quite frank, they don't make a terribly good display animal because they spend all their time living in a burrow. So
I'm quite privileged to have seen one today.
You're very privileged to have seen one.
Well, thank you.
We just heard from Tom Wilson and his introduction to the sunset frog via Helen Robertson from the Perth Zoo.
Understory, environmental news on RTR FM 92.1.
Now we have our last interview for today's program. Adrian Glamorgan spoke with the Wilderness Society's State Director, Peter Robertson, about some of the things that matter most in our top end.
Obviously at the moment there's a huge amount of focus on the marine environment, the Kimberley, and the oil spill, and the recent approval for the Gorgon LNG project on Barrow Island. So there's just a lot of activity on in our coastal and marine environment, some of which is heading in the right direction, and some of which is very much heading in the wrong direction as far as we're concerned.
Well, what top three things do you think are working well at the moment?
Well, there's a Commonwealth marine planning process underway at the moment in both our southwest marine waters and also in the northwest, and that's being driven by the Federal Department of Environment and Minister Garrett, and that is supposed to be coming up with a system of protected areas in the Commonwealth waters off WA's coast. So by and large, that seems to be heading in a reasonably positive direction, mainly thanks to the efforts of the Save Our Marine Life campaign, which is going very well and is generating thousands and thousands of emails and letters to federal ministers and members of parliament regarding the need to protect our marine environment. So that's going pretty well, but at the same time we've got some pretty scary things happening with the Gorgon project on Barrow Island, the proposed Woodside LNG project just near Broome, and of course the oil spill off the far Kimberley coast. You know, we need the public to be aware and engaged in these issues without pressure from the public about protecting our marine environment and preventing damaging and dangerous activities in the marine environment. Then of course politicians will succumb to the pressure that they're under from the big oil and gas interests around our coast. So it's obviously critically important that people who care about our marine environment speak up and make their views known to state and federal members of parliament.
What's driving Gorgon to be where it is, for example? Why does it need to be just where it is, and why does the pipeline need to be just where it is?
Well, these are very good questions, and we don't believe they've ever been satisfactorily answered. I mean, if you look at the Gorgon project, for example, I mean, even the Premier in years gone by strongly said that it shouldn't go on Barrow Island, it should go on the mainland. He at the time was talking more from
what he perceived to be the limitations of the island in terms of possible future expansion of the project. But nonetheless, then there has never been a proper justification as to why the Gorgon LNG project has to go on Barrow Island. And environment groups have long been arguing that it should go on the mainland.
Hmm.
And, you know, there are obvious reasons why that should happen and obvious benefits from doing it, not only environmental but also, we believe, economic in terms of piping distances and the capacity to put projects in one location together rather than spreading them up and down the coast. So, and a similar story goes with the proposed LNG plant at James Price Point north of Broome, where once again we think that governments are rushing into decisions without having properly looked at the alternatives and without having properly looked at the impacts that those projects will have both environmentally and economically.
What are the lessons of the oil spill then?
Well, the lessons of the oil spill are many. Obviously, the more oil and gas activity that is occurring off our coast, the more risk there is that things will go wrong. And of course, we all know that resources are very stretched and our capacity to deal with serious accidents and incidents like this in remote marine areas are very limited. And we don't believe enough has been put in place. On the one hand, the protection measures that would prevent these sorts of activities happening in the most sensitive marine environments. And on the other hand, there's not enough effort put into making sure that if and when these accidents happen, that they are properly addressed. So, for example, at the moment, you know, we're seeing with the West Atlas spill weeks and weeks and weeks of pollution of the marine environment and the atmosphere, with very little capacity to do anything about it, and the potential risks and impacts of that spill getting worse every day. So we really are not doing enough either to protect the environment from this sort of activity on the one hand, or to address it when and if it happens.
You've been listening to Understory on RTRFM 92.1. We just heard there from Adrian Glamorgan talking to Peter Robertson from the Wilderness Society. That's all for the program today. I'm Lisa Litchens and thank you for listening in. You can catch the Understory team at the same time next Wednesday morning. ¶¶